I am Felipe da Rosa. Well, I miss the DA here, but that's kind of ambiguous about my name anyway. So, and I will talk about Casimir Forces and Metamaterials. This work was done in collaboration with Diego Dalvit and Peter Miloni, to whom I'm very grateful for all the help and for the opportunity to be here in the USA. I'm also very grateful to all the organizers for giving me the opportunity of being here in this wonderful place and the opportunity to give a talk as well. And the first thing I want to talk about is to make a pledge that I will be over before dinner. So
dinner today.
Yeah. And
fucking break.
Yeah. And I'll try to make for the coffee break. So, and well, this work, we began to think about doing something like that, motivated by the fact that with the construction of these so-called metamaterials, which I will tell a little bit more explicitly what they are, at least in my definition, with the proposition and construction of these guys, there arose the possibility of creating repulsive Casimir forces even when you have vacuum between plane systems. So, well, if there is a possibility, how realistic is that possibility with realistic metamaterials? And this is the kind of thing we are interested in this talk. So it's kind of maybe complementary to Francesco's talk, because he was talking about more fundamental stuff, so to speak. I'll try to get a little bit more practical here. So, and this talk is basically an outline of our work. I'll try to skip most of the calculations, just give you the basic idea of what we try to do. And of course, we shall begin by the usual Casimir effect with two perfect plates here. And I thank Francesco for providing this figure. And the only reason that I have to show this picture is because of my conventions. I'm probably opposite to 95% of the people here in the room. I'm using positive for attraction. So a plus sign here means that this force is attractive. So when we have this expression, and when we generalize this formula to real materials, we have a formula that's like that. And so what we call the Lifshitz formula, although in his original paper, Lifshitz didn't care about any magnetic permeability at all. And he was in vacuum as well, so 3 mu 3 and epsilon 3 in his case were 1. And I'm only showing this formula here to basically give a hint of what could produce repulsion. And from this formula, it's not that difficult. This is all written in the imaginary axis, so everything here is positive. This is modulus of k, this is a square root. In the exponent here, we have positive quantities, except from this product here. This guy, well, he appears also in the denominator as well, but in the denominator we have this guy, this product here has modulus less than 1 times something that has modulus less than 1, 1 minus that cannot change sign. So the only possibility for this thing to get a minus here, if I can sustain a cross product here over a large range of imaginary frequencies and k's. So, and we can think about that and come up with ways of effectively giving an example of that. And one that comes about is when you have two dissimilar plates, in the sense that this one's mainly electric, so epsilon much larger than mu, and the other is just the other way around. We have mu much larger than epsilon. When we have these conditions, this product can be negative in this notation for a large range of frequencies and transverse momenta. Of course, the ideal case being produced by Boyer in 74, where if you have the R's exactly crossed, so 1 and minus 1 over the whole range of frequencies and k's, you get minus 7/8 of the usual Casimir force.
This is interesting in the sense that the same 7/8 you get if you compare directly and directly non.
Yeah, exactly,
Is that a coincidence or is it?
It's In this case here, maybe it's not because the plane geometry.
Right.
So it'll
kind of, I mean, the large distance is kind of a static limit, and you look more or less like
Steven, do you remember for one loop calculation, formal one loop calculation, Bose loop, formula loop?
I can't explain it in those terms, but I think it's
where you have also some base.
Okay, can I just...
There are things to say about it, but they're not on the tip of my tongue. Let me pass.
So, Thorsten.
Okay, thanks.
And this was assuming this inequality is holding, but we didn't...
Yeah, perfect. Yeah. Just, mu infinity here, epsilon infinity here, so... Yeah. Plain simple. So.
The Neumann boundary condition appears in magnetostatics, and maybe that's the link actually. If you have a very magnetic material, which is kind
Yeah, sure.
And the other one turns to directly, and that's maybe the reason you get.
Yeah, and you get, and we get, and
kind of perfect limit.
And we get a factor of 2 in both of them, so when you, the ratio is the same, so 7/8.
Oddly enough, maybe I was just thinking maybe to talk about this on Friday. If you did the other thing, which is to recognize finite temperature, and you got to distances where most of the finite frequencies were screened, that's the real long distance, right?
Yeah.
You might actually realize this.
Really?
Looking in the wrong place, not the Casimir limit.
Okay. Interesting.
That is perhaps the path to a practical application.
Oh, nice. Okay.
And we've heard many times here measurements being done to micron separation, where you're really down to the very low frequencies.
Okay.
Maybe, paradoxically, that may be the place you find this thing.
Nice.
That's more than smile, because this is basically poetry.
Okay. Yeah. So now you're going to have to talk about that on Friday, because you got me interested on that. And why is this interesting from a practical point of view? Well, this is interesting, and when I mean Casimir here, I'm talking about not only the retarded regime, but Casimir in the broader sense that I can in principle go to the van der Waals limit as well. So it's kind of it encircles all the regimes you can have. So in principle, it could be interesting to, if not avoid stiction problems, at least to make them less frequent or diminish the problem of stiction. Maybe if not stiction, somehow to diminish friction as well between all these guys here. These are all pictures of these micro machines where this kind of consideration might play a role here in order to facilitate the working of these guys. Of course, here we have also huge problems with the geometry. Geometry might also play a role in diminishing the Casimir force, in changing the Casimir force in general. But more than that, more than work with MEMS, I found this article in the Telegraph. And in principle, we could use the theory to levitate a person. So, which is a lot more optimistic than...
That's what you can do if you have only strong enough magnetic field.
And of course,
you can levitate frogs.
And this story here was related to, particularly to repulsive Casimir forces. So it might be fair to say that they were a bit optimistic. I'm not.
I was clicking one day. I found this, and then I said, "Adrian, you're really wasting time."
They might be a little over-optimistic, and basically that's the kind of thing that led us to investigate what could happen with real metamaterials, at least real so far. And
this paper was about metamaterials also, right?
What?
This thing.
The possibility of reversing the Casimir effect with metamaterials. So we have all these issues, we have all these new possibilities. I mean, not this one, but the former ones. When you have Casimir repulsion, why are we not trying to implement that? And the reason is that, unfortunately, nature was not kind enough to provide us with the materials necessary with materials with the magnetic the necessary magnetic activity in order to be important to Casimir effects. For instance, here we see two examples of ferrites, and despite the fact in this axis I'm putting mu, this axis is frequency, this here is 1 gigahertz, and we see already that at 1 gigahertz we have, I mean, in this scale it's not negligible, but if you go even further, you see that this gets very close to 1. And okay, this may be high frequency for certain applications, but for Casimir this is very, very low frequencies. Yet this guy is having a huge magnetic activity here. This does not play a role in Casimir calculations. We want actually this decay here to be a lot further in the frequency scale. So, and I think there are reports of materials like that where you can push this to maybe 100 gigahertz, but this is still not high frequency for Casimir purposes. So we would like these guys to be a lot further in the scale here.
Do you remember the first Matsubara frequency?
No.
It's probably on the blackboard or something.
And
no, I mean it extended the line. Yeah, sure.
Which time culture?
Well, in terms of dynamic, a huge difference, but it's only a factor of 100 on this scale. It's not going to do much good.
And that's where and that's where basically metamaterials came about. And by metamaterials here I mean only materials that were designed to present some specific electromagnetic property. They may be left-handed media or not in principle. So, and because with these guys there is a possibility that we can go further on the frequency scale, try to get some magnetic activity where we need, and that's basically what motivates us to study this kind of problem. So this metamaterials, they can be negative, they can have negative index of refraction, and then we would realize the left-handed metamaterials, so in which we have, as we have negative n, the refraction is to the wrong side here. So we get this kind of weird refraction, and this would be a straw if placed in a liquid with some negative index of refraction. Instead of seeing the straw like that, it would see something weirdly curved like this. And of course, another example of metamaterial, and this is what is really keeping the money flowing into this business, is the cloaking of objects. So this is just a picture. And the idea is that putting the metamaterial here, we can somehow dictate how light propagates inside the metamaterial, making it go around the object you want to cloak and then leave exactly as it came. So if you put a detector here, it cannot tell the difference if there was an object here or not. And this is an actual experiment of a cloaking of a cylinder. So the cylinder is here. And this is the simulation with the ideal properties. So we see almost perfect cloaking here. This is the actual experiment. So it's of course not perfect. You're putting a veil, if you like. But it shows already some very promising results. This was for 8.5 gigahertz, if I remember correctly. So microwave. And so the structures here, the wave, in order the wave to follow this pattern here, the wave should see this guy as an effective medium with the properties that you want. But these guys don't have to be very small in this case, because here we are at microwave. So this is another thing that's pretty interesting. This is another effect, very interesting effect, that you can get by using metamaterials. And
what's B?
Case B is the simulation with what they called reduced parameters. So it's some kind of approximate that I think would be easier to construct as compared to this guy. And this is the scattering with no cloaking. So this is the experiment with. And so this is, this is an actual experiment with cloaking. So there are very interesting things going on in the realm of metamaterials. And we decided that we should take a shot and see if they were as useful for cloaking. If they can be as useful for Casimir purposes as they are useful for cloaking. So this is a picture I'm kind of I'm kind of taking advantage that Francesco gave a talk just before me, and he showed exactly this picture. So this is one example of a metamaterial. And well, how does that work, at least in this case? In this case, let's try to zoom out here.
Can you give a scale? Can you give a scale between
the... Oh, sorry, this is, I mean, the mean space here between the two pillars is like 100 nanometers. So...
And the space in between the rows is more micrometer.
The space between what?
Perpendicular to it.
I think maybe, 300 or 400 nanometers. So, and it's so that this is very small. Yeah, and I should have put the scale here, sorry. And when you have something like that, if we zoom in on a given pillar, if I put an electric field like this, it's not surprising that for a given frequency, at least, these guys kind of lock in this collective state of, you know, displaced charge. And if the field is oscillating, I have this oscillating in phase like that. And this, of course, gives me a contribution to the to epsilon, at least in this direction for the material. So on top of the contribution of the substrate, which is below, and the intrinsic contributions of these materials here, I have to take into account now that I have a contribution like that induced by this geometry. But we can have also different effects. Strangely enough, if I put a field like that, I can induce this kind of arrangement, which are dipoles oscillating in opposite phase. So what I get here is effectively a severed loop here. So this would give me a magnetic activity in this direction. And that's how I excite magnetic activity artificially, if you like. So in this case, so if we are in the right frequency, and of course, in this case, in the right direction, we can somehow excite resonant contributions to mu and epsilon. And that's the basic idea behind most metamaterials. They excite the magnetic and electric activity by resonant effects like that. Of course, designs can vary a lot, but the main idea is to produce some artificial resonant, which will give you some contribution to mu and epsilon. And, well, in order to try to assess what they can do for us, we have to do an actual calculation. So I want to begin from the very beginning, which is to assume that I have a metal, isotropic metal here, described by epsilon 1 and mu 1, and I have here a metal material, which for now I'll keep isotropic, epsilon 2 and mu 2.
Can you give some wave? I mean, it's definitely not isotropic at a microscopic scale.
Yeah.
When does it look isotropic? Which
wavelengths? And that depends on the metamaterial. For certain metamaterials, never.
One neutral.
No, never. That example is never isotropic. And it's even not only it's not isotropic, but it's polarization dependent. It's a mess.
But for other metamaterials, would you ever see something that is isotropic? To make the plate.
That, my friend, is the question. I don't know. Nobody produced one yet. At least there are some suggestions of isotropic metamaterials, but as far as I know, they are confined to the microwave regime, which is not interesting for us. So, and I don't know. This is an open question, and I don't know. Maybe, but it seems to be very difficult for me, in my opinion, at least. But we have to begin somewhere, and if there are problems already at this level, why bother to go even further and further, try to get even more refinements if we can access something working with this model. And there is at least one thing that we can do. And so if we consider an isotropic guy like this with epsilon 2 and mu 2, an isotropic metal with epsilon 1 and mu 1, and vacuum in between, this distance between them is d. Now I thought I wrote a in the previous slide. Sorry about that. And I want to be as simple as I can, so I model my metal with an epsilon, which is basically a Drude response, and no mu, so just a simple metal. And this, if we are talking about resonant effects, the simplest thing we could do to try to model these resonant effects is try to guess some drew the formulas like that, and then we fit these parameters, and then we see what happened. But unfortunately, we can do that. And if we just plug these formulas in Lipschitz formula with this, if this guy is basically larger than this one by a certain factor, you get repulsion, and then that's established. But I want to go to the question whether it's realistic with present-day materials to guess something like that. And the first issue that, so for some metamaterials, this might be not good enough, because for some metamaterials, for instance, this is another example of a metamaterial, this silver thing here is metal, these are actually holes. So we have like what they call fishnet structure. So we can already see that, and they excite here the same kind of resonant behavior I showed you before. I can go in the details of that later after the talk, if somebody's interested. But the thing is, despite this electrical and magnetical resonance contribution, we have also at least conductivity in this direction and in this direction, which in this case is intrinsic of this kind of structure. So we have to take that into account when we do an actual calculation. So instead of having the usual resonant contribution for epsilon, we have to add some Drude contribution with a filling factor, which gives basically the amount of metal you have. And that metal I showed you before was not isotropic, but then again, let's assume that it is for the moment. So this would be the total answer, this for epsilon in your metamaterial. So when you rotate, you get something like that. You can plug in Lipschitz formula with that epsilon mu that I showed you. And what you get is this result. This is force time d cubed. So that's why you get this nice van der Waals behavior here, because it grows with d cubed. So and with 1 over d cubed, sorry. And we see that this would be f equals 0. This would be f 10 to the minus 4. And this already, with f 10 to the minus 3, which is tiny, you already get no repulsion at all. And this is, well, and this is related basically to this plot, is that, I mean, as in very general lines, what you have, what you want in order to have repulsion is to have mu larger than epsilon, the imaginary axis, over a considerable bandwidth. And this for sure happens here when you compare this guy with the mu that I used in calculation. So this is mu held constant throughout. And for these three curves, I have used these three epsilons, differing only by these filling factors here. So we see that if we add just a little bit of Drude, because it diverges as I go close to zero, it of course will surpass this curve at some point. And if I enhance f, it will surpass even earlier if I'm on this direction. And it so happens that here, this is already enough for, in the reflection coefficient, instead of having this guy minus this guy, a positive quantity, we have a negative quantity because this guy grows. So this guy does not give you the minus sign you wanted to.
And no epsilon on mu averages over space or no?
Well,
space dependence.
No, yeah, this is only, and yeah, constant epsilon dependence only with frequency, so no local effect as well, yeah. And of course, this is only a first approximation for the real thing.
So where's the limit in that previous slide you showed? Where's the limit whether light material is the Lipschitz limit?
What is the limit?
Where can I see this? Can I see this on this plot where the
for normal materials?
No, for both materials or for a symmetric situation.
Well, they would be here.
It should be way up.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So because you get only attraction if you have like normal metals, you say?
Right.
So it should be something like this. So with an asymptotic behavior here of 1 over d cubed, an asymptotic behavior here of 1 over d4, and something in between. So
the material property you assume is not based on a real concoction yet, it's just what you would need for this so far.
In what sense?
The Fs that you have assumed and the susceptibilities that go in there, those are...
Oh, see if those are realistic Fs?
Yeah.
No. There's only... Because if with F 0.00, you already get that, it does, in this plot at least, doesn't make sense to put maybe a realistic F, which would be a lot which would be at least 0.2 or 0.3, this would be a lot. You'd have attraction all the way, so there is no qualitatively difference from the metal-metal case. So already here, so if we have, and the main point here is that just a little bit of a Drude contribution already kind of kills you if you're going to try to get repulsion. So
the other question is, if you're really trying to go between plus and minus, weakening the force altogether, having a medium, that wouldn't help you?
Yeah, yeah. That's, but, and you can get even repulsion by just having different, and you don't have to talk about magnetic activity at all, just having epsilon, epsilon 2. So if we had a medium, then, yeah, the force would.
So you could play that game.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, definitely. And, yeah, provided I might get, yeah, if the medium is isotropic, I think it's not that difficult to implement with the machinery I already have, so.
You can find an anisotropic fluid.
Yeah.
Business for less.
Okay.
But I guess that the main research is looking for something working in vacuum.
Yeah. And we are.
Maybe it makes it easier not to.
Yeah, because then if you are thinking about practical applications, you would have to insert everything in the medium that might be, and that might be the case. So, but.
Well. Then you have friction for other reasons.
Right? Yeah, sure. But in our case here, we are concerned with vacuum effects and how you can get repulsions sustaining that vacuum. As the issue was already brought about, a Drude background is not the only issue here. It's we have typical metamaterials are anisotropic. So if you want to go towards some realistic calculations, we have to take account of that fact. So the usual, and I'm assuming here only what some people call uni-anisotropy, so no mixing between D and B, or H and E. So D is a tensor times E, H is a tensor times B, and these are the tensors. In this case, I'm assuming only some kind of geometric anisotropy, so this guy is symmetric, this guy will be symmetric as well at best. So the worst case scenario, we would have six independent epsilons to play, six independent mu's, and these guys would be related by simple symmetric relations. So speaking of anisotropic materials, we can have a huge amount of different materials and situations, but if we are talking about periodic structures, as we are interested here, we can use all the framework developed in condensed matter and split different kinds of anisotropy in the different lattices, so the usual Bravais lattices. And in this case here, it would be even more convenient to group these guys into a larger set. So, for instance, because if you take a look to this guy here, this guy has three orthogonal crystallographic equivalent directions, so it's isotropic for every purpose. And so, we already dealt with this case, and there's something special about this, and this, is that they are symmetric enough in order to have two directions which are crystallographic equivalents spanning a plane. So you basically have what people call an uniaxial material, and the practical result of having an uniaxial material is that in your epsilon setting of have a tensor, you have a diagonal epsilon which has two elements that generate and just one different. Here you have they are all the same. Here you have something which is something of this sort for all these guys here. And these are of particular interest, at least for the point where our research is. These guys are of particular interest. In our paper, we dealt also with the biaxial media, which is the one that, which are the these three here, and they have, and then they are much more difficult. They don't have any independent equivalent direction. So, and this guy still a lot easier, still a bit easier than these two, but we are basically, we're mainly concerned about these two guys here, and that's because most metamaterials are actually stacks of things like this. So we have two equivalent directions, and the directions where you're stacking, that's the very different, that would give, in principle, a very different electromagnetic response. So keeping that in mind, we begin our study with an isotropic material, considering a uniaxial material, where the axis is, of course, on the, it's parallel to d, to it's parallel to the distance here between the plates. So, and which is kind of the easiest departure from the usual isotropic case. And when we have something like this, like I said, epsilons and mu's are just given by diagonal elements, with two elements being the same and one being different. And the nice thing about having the axis like this is that you still have rotation symmetry about this plane here. So those guys, they don't lose this diagonal character in any orientation that you choose. If you had a uniaxial material, but like this, then you don't have this rotation anymore. So epsilon would depend on the way you do the reflection here, would depend on the angle, on this angle in the plane, which makes things a lot more difficult. So we have something like this, and by assuming the same kind of response for both independent epsilons and both independent mu's, what can we get if instead of trying to reduce the Drude background as a whole, what would happen if we could reduce the background in one direction, but still allow for a Drude background in the other direction? Do we get, our situation gets a little bit better, we can get higher F's, and it's just a matter of trying to plug these guys in the Lipschitz formula. As we don't have an isotropic material anymore, Lipschitz formula in principle is not the same, but in this case, as it's completely it's symmetric from this point of view, you could still make this calculation here, see that this guy still supports CE and TM waves, so the reflection matrix here, it's still diagonal on the TE-TM basis. They are just slightly different from the usual case. So what we have is just, instead of a matrix product, we only have the summation of TE and TM with slightly different reflection coefficients. We plug that in, and then we get this formula where what I'm plotting is this force for a fixed distance, normalized by this factor here. And here is F on the perpendicular direction, this is F on the parallel direction, and I'm leaving all the other parameters fixed. So everything that everything that is changing is fx and fz in this notation here. So
about 30 years ago, when we made our first formulation,
the
anisotropy,
yeah,
we did a calculation where we said we took two uniaxial crystals,
yeah,
took their data, and then made believe that the melt had an average of the epsilons of the things. And you can clearly see going from repulsion to attraction to repulsion as you rotate through those angles, just for exactly the kind of reasoning
okay.
I'm talking about.
Okay.
It's a natural system to take something with natural anisotropy and then create something as isotropic but as close to the two axes as possible.
Okay.
So it's quite a clear torque that you get.
Okay.
Interesting.
Sure, yeah, sure, of course. You get both torque and repulsive force.
Yeah, well, it better be. I
mean, yeah.
You can't have one without the other.
Okay, so and what we have here is that we can get repulsion, but our situation is not much better. We still have to get to pretty low Fs in order to go to this region here where it's below zero. So unfortunately, if you want to have repulsion and you are dealing with a metallic metamaterial with a large Drude background, you have to suppress it isotropically.
What is this? What did you do to get this picture? I mean, what did you solve?
I just took these guys and put in a formula which is exactly the same as the formula I show in the third slide, Lifshitz-Jalasinski formula.
But that's for isotropic epsilon.
Yeah, but the thing is, for this kind of anisotropy, the formula is the same. You don't have to, you just have to change a little bit the reflection coefficients.
Why don't you just use the formula that there is for the epsilons? I mean, you can solve that. Exactly.
Yeah, no, and that's, and that's probably, and you were, and that we are probably talking about the same thing.
I did it.
Yeah, exactly. So,
you can do it too.
And no, but and I think because one of the checks of our paper
right.
was to get the results in your paper,
right.
and we were able
but
to
I
do that.
Do this analytically, actually.
Okay. And
analytically, in a sense, you can get a close form, just calculate the numbers without.
Okay. Yeah, because here it's analytical in the sense that we can calculate the reflection coefficients and put in the Lifshitz formula, and they are quite similar to the isotropic ones. So, and then we have that, and continuing with our issues about metamaterials, we can get to the issue of how to describe magnetic activity, because what we have been doing so far is say, okay, we have a resonance, and we model the resonance by a formula like that, but in order to calculate the force, we need actually this guy over an infinite range of frequencies. And what we were doing was to assume that this guy hold for the whole range of frequencies and do the calculations. But actually, the data that people get in order to when people try to see how metamaterials respond to electromagnetic radiation, what they do is actually observe it in a tiny band. So we don't have data to try to fit this and see if this is accurate or not. So and it may turn out that this is not accurate. For instance, if we have a metamaterial like that, and this was one of the first metamaterials put forward in the market by John Pendry and collaborators, and we have basically a stack. This is a cylinder. I'm not drawing the double sheet here because it would be just too confusing, but these are double sheet cylinders like that. So the top view of these guys is something like this. And they are split here and here. So double layered and split cylinders. And so when the magnetic field comes like this, you can excite the same resonant behavior we could, for instance, in the nanopillars case. And what they found by analyzing this guy analytically is that in first approximation, the response, the magnetic response of this guy was something like that, which resembles a lot Drude-Lorentz formulas, but they have this omega 2 here in the numerator. And the thing about this omega 2 in the numerator is that when you rotate, it gives you an extra minus. So in the imaginary axis, we have something like that. C is by construction less than 1. It's a filling factor. It's basically the cross section of the cylinder here divided by the unit cell here. So it's necessarily less than 1. But what we have here is that in imaginary frequencies, we have mu, which is something between 0 and 1. So epsilon 2, which if it's modeled by something like Drude or Drude-Lorentz, so it's bigger than 1. So we have something like this. This is expressed in this plot. And as a result, we have a force that never goes negative. This is the force with this new model here. This is the force with the old model. And in this model here, of course, the force is not growing. That's just because I'm multiplying here by d cubed. So it's always decreasing, but it changes the power law. And so, yeah.
So in principle, this what you call the mu and the epsilon, these are effective.
Yeah, they hold. Yeah.
In principle, I mean, it seems to me that what you change actually is the geometry, and so you, I mean, for example, at first you showed this fish.
Yeah.
So I mean, you could also think of this as a modification of geometry, and then you still, I'm not sure, that's just the normal metal probably.
Yeah.
Made of
well.
Or whatever, and then you could
Maybe it's just cement.
I'm not sure that the filling factor description that applies probably only at very large.
No, sure. Yeah. I'm saying that in this, I mean, to get this, of course, to get this guy here, there are some approximation. You must be much larger than some characteristic length of your system, and in that regime, this is true.
But couldn't one measure not just directly the reflection amplitude, but shining light?
I think
the structures not these functions, but the scattering amplitude directly?
I think in principle they could, but the fact is most people that are interested in metamaterials, they are interested in very specific frequencies, where are the frequencies that will shine light and you get negative refraction and that stuff. So what they do is basically get the best measurements that they can in that region and forget about the rest. So but of course this would be the ideal, to get measurements of a whole in the whole spectrum, or in the larger part of the spectrum we can. And so, but what this is not, but what this result is saying is basically that, because this is valid on the low frequency regime, so maybe all the low frequency tail of the Drude-Lorentz formulas might be inaccurate, because this guy deviates from the usual Drude-Lorentz formulas quite a lot. For given these two parameters here, the parameter in the denominator is not the same. They are not the same, so they can be directly compared. But for the same omega and the same dissipation, this formula in the low end of the spectrum can gives very different results from the old mu. And this, so it's kind of a general statement about the low frequency regime behavior.
It's monotonic.
And
it's monotonic. What was the question?
Yeah.
It's of course monotonic.
From
goes to 1 minus c, a big sign, right? And
yeah.
So just that gentle little bit.
Yeah. So something like it is here.
Let me see.
Yeah, because the denominator is always larger than this guy.
You can divide by sigma squared through, I think, and then that's probably easier to see. Or by zeta squared, divide by zeta squared of numerator and denominator.
And everything's 1 over c, so c starts very big. 1 over c starts very big, and
it gets larger.
Anyways, it doesn't have any problems with
monotonicity. Okay, yeah. And because this ratio is zero and it grows to. And that's basically everything that I had to talk about. So this is the last slide, and I'm not finished yet, but yeah. And so one of our biggest assumptions here in all this calculation was that the effective medium holds throughout our regime, and this of course may not be true. Actually, we are already pushing it a little bit, because the smallest structures that people can build are around 80 nanometers. So to go to distance of, let's say, 500 nanometers might be already a stretch. It's not absurd, but it's probably, it can be done better if properties of the medium itself, not only its effective properties, can be taken into account. The problem with that is, at least to my mind, as all the magnetic behavior comes from the effective response, typically corrections from effective medium will depart in order to get you away from repulsion, because then the wave would resolve the material and then they would see the actual components, and the components are made of normal metals. So, and temperature has a kind of, it's not such a simple an effect in this kind of thing, particularly with this controversy if you plug in the formulas Drude or plasma model, which I'll not get into, but, and we are kind of pessimistic on experiments measuring some repulsion in this kind of setup, but to measure some reduced attraction might be not too off. So we are kind of checking, putting some more realistic numbers even into these guys and see if current experiments or at least the next generation of experiments could see some reduced attraction. At least that would be great. So thanks a lot. So,
is it really so awful to work with media?
No, it's great.
I mean, vacuum has all these problems with contamination too.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of tuning possibilities.
If you put medium in between.
Roger French, who I guess not enough of you met, but he works at DuPont, where he had developed 120 different dialects, different description for a toner process that DuPont decided not to use, but now we have all this great set of compounds with dielectric data.
If you want to create an engine, nano-engine,
right,
then you better have no medium around, isn't it?
It's exactly what Andreas was saying. If you put a medium through it, you get the friction.
Well, no, for sure there are problems, but one of them is that you can't make a device more easily. I suspect you can make a device a lot more easily. Yes, it's a super cool.
If you are not worried about friction, you can just glue them together. Right?
You can glue them each other. I want a switchable glue. Yeah, just the thought. It's such a nice set of possibilities here. I'm just thinking if some of these media that have been developed.
Okay. Yeah. Sure.
Worth thinking about.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And
But I mean, you need three media, right? I mean, one metal, one medium, and one even less medium.
A little bit better camera.
So you don't have two metals. I mean, even if you put something in between, that doesn't help you, unless it has a very funny liquid. You have two metals, and when you have a funny liquid. Maybe ferromagnetic liquid or whatever. I mean that.
Maybe in some company there's some not funny, hilarious liquid. Really coming handy.
Or liquid mercury. I don't know.
Wait a minute. this is in China.
But you do it with liquid, but then you have probably a carbon effect.
Questions?
So I have a question.
Yeah.
If you have materials where the magnetic response is kind of strong, imagine an experiment, having a constant experiment, where I apply also an external field, or is it modulated? What happens? Because there is a chance that you can see the modulation.
And I must say that this is at least thinking in progress.
Okay.
We just thought about that. I cannot tell you. I don't have any intuition of what it would do, and we haven't made any specific calculations. So,
and there would be a response.
Just
a question. When you were speaking about this anisotropy and you can get the torque,
yeah,
there are some numbers about the torque, because people are there is a famous paper on Barash and Ginsburg. About the estimation of the torque, and the effect is very small. Paolo and Acid and other guys proposed that torque due to the geometry of the surface.
I bet this torque here would be smaller, even smaller than this one, and it would be mainly an electric torque. I mean, the magnetic torque would be exceedingly small, I think.
Smaller of the Jeruzhinsky one, of the Barash one, of the...
No, if we take, for instance, you take this anisotropic mu's and epsilons that I have here, and try to calculate the torque, if you have, then you must have an anisotropic material on the other side as well. And if you calculate the effect of different epsilons, and you can get some torque if the axes are misaligned. If this is purely an electrical effect like that, some resonance that you excited and then you produce some epsilon in a weird direction, I bet that this would be a lot smaller than the effect of geometric torque.
About the anisotropy of the crystal, for example, in the Barash result?
Well, then, no, I don't know. I have to take the numbers in and see, but yeah. So, all right.
Thank you.
Thank you.